Blog Talk Radio.
Without the light, or the darkness comes. Hold through the night, the shadows will run. Fend off the enemy. The jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. Night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise.
An expose of judicial and executive fraud in administration of the income tax. The truth, the lies, the reasons, and the bottom line. That's what we're going to be looking at today. We're going to expose some outright judicial falsehoods that appear in actual appellate court, federal appellate court rulings, in which the courts, in order to make rulings contrary to the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the subject of the income tax, actually lie about the content of Supreme Court rulings on this subject. And the same thing is repeated by the Internal Revenue Service in its publications and in its behavior in legal contests, as we're going to see. So, over the decades, state and federal tax agencies, with the occasional assistance of some courts, have engaged in a massive subterfuge of misapplying the income tax contrary to the law of the tax as it's written and contrary to the rulings of the Supreme Court, the court whose rulings effectively constitute the law of the land. They hold the same significance as precedent and as authority over all institutions of government as the Constitution does itself in practical terms. And under our legal system, that's the way we view it. There is nothing that can be said by an appellate court, a tax court, any lower judicial tribunal that that matches or overrides the rulings of the Supreme Court. So we can look at the Supreme Court rulings to see what is the status of the law today, and we're gonna look at some of those, and we're gonna take a look at instances in which lower courts and executive agencies have attempted to evade those rulings. When I say that the lower courts have lied about the Supreme Court rulings on the subject of the tax, I'm not talking about them lying in the sense of interpreting the Supreme Court rulings differently than another court might interpret them. Or even disagreeing with the rulings of the court. I'm talking about lower court decisions in which the actual text of the Supreme Court rulings is misstated. It's deliberately misstated, as we'll see. So this is not a casual or inadvertent or unwitting mistake or falsification. This is an outright deliberate falsification, and we're going to take a look at the rulings, and we're going to see that. So we're going to look at what the Supreme Court actually says about the nature and limits of the income tax, and we're going to look at the falsifications of these lower courts and the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. And we're going to take a look at the harm that's been accomplished by this these falsifications, and we're going to see a little bit about, we're going to see a lot about what it is that they're trying to conceal with their false statements. Now here's the truth about what the Supreme Court has ruled and what is the standing settled law of the land regarding the nature of the income tax. In 1916, after the 16th Amendment was adopted 3 years previously, a number of challenges had arisen to the implementation of the income tax when it was revived in 1913, promptly upon the adoption of the 16th Amendment. The tax at that time was 51 years old already, but it had been on hiatus. It had been dormant since 1895, when the Supreme Court had ruled in the case of Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust that as far as the application to two different things, dividends and rents, the application of the tax caused it to become a property tax rather than an income tax by an argument of resort to the source from which the income was derived. That is, the personal property in the form of stock and in the form of real estate from which rent and dividends were derived. The court said this actually constitutes, for all practical purposes, a tax on those sources rather than the income itself, rather than the activity that produced the taxable activity that produced the gains, and therefore it's a property tax, and therefore it has to be apportioned as a direct tax. That was the reasoning in the Pollock case. 16th Amendment overturns that, and we'll get to that in a moment. So in 1916, this revival of the income tax was challenged by a man named Frank Bruchever, who was a stockholder in the Union Pacific Railroad Company, a railroad which is a national instrumentality in which the dividends from that stock was naturally an excisable gain. Bruchever argued that the 16th Amendment had the effect of creating a direct non-apportioned tax. That is to say, a tax that functioned as a capitation or other direct tax, and yet wasn't subject to the apportionment rule that applies to all such taxes under the Constitution. The court, in a unanimous decision, disagreed. The Bruchever ruling unambiguously confines the income tax to the objects and administrative rules of an indirect excise tax only. Bruchever holds that the sole purpose and effect of the 16th Amendment is to undo and overrule its conclusion in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust, which I mentioned a moment ago, that a tax on otherwise excise taxable dividends and rent becomes a property tax in those particular instances. Pollock had reasoned that the linkage of dividends and rent to their personal property sources, the stock or the real estate from which they are derived, transforms the income excise on those gains into a property tax on the sources, which therefore requires apportionment. The 16th Amendment, says the Bruchever Court, severs or prohibits the source linkage imagined by the Pollock Court. This overruling allowed the by-then 51-year-old income tax to be revived and to resume application as the excise tax it has always been. Bruchever very expressly rules that the 16th Amendment does not accomplish its task by creating some kind of hybrid tax, which can have the character of a capitation or other direct tax and yet not be subject to the apportionment rule, a non-apportioned direct tax. This was, in fact, the exact contention of Frank Bruchever, against whom the court ruled, who reasoned from this faulty notion the confused conclusion that the post-amendment revival of the income tax created a constitutional conflict. Here's what the unanimous Supreme Court says, among a lot of other things in what is really a very long, thoughtful, and comprehensive ruling, well worth reading, even though Justice White, the Chief Justice White, who wrote it, was a man who was fond of 60-word sentences, and so it's a little bit of a slog to get through it, but nonetheless, good material. Here's what they said. Again, a unanimous Supreme Court. We are of the opinion that the confusion is not inherent, but rather arises from the conclusion that the 16th Amendment provides for a hitherto unknown power of taxation, that is, a power to levy an income tax, which, although direct, should not be subject to the regulation of apportionment applicable to all other direct taxes. And the far-reaching effect of this erroneous assumption, you notice that's in bold because this is what the court is saying. This is an erroneous assumption. It does not do this. Will be made clear by generalizing the many contentions advanced in argument to support it. Bruchever had argued 15 different approaches in his effort to try and argue that this tax was unconstitutional. And the reason for that was simple. His dividends from his Union Pacific Railroad stock were being taxed before being distributed, and he wanted to stop that. So this is the nature of his argument. So that's Bruchever versus Union Pacific Railroad, 240 U.S. 1, 1916. The court goes on to point out that the very idea of a non-apportioned direct tax is incoherent because it would cause one provision of the Constitution to destroy another. That is, it would result in bringing the provisions of the amendment, supposedly exempting a direct tax from apportionment, into irreconcilable conflict with the general requirement that all direct taxes be apportioned. You'll note the 16th Amendment does not repeal the apportionment requirement at all. This result, instead of simplifying the situation and making clear the limitations on the taxing power, which obviously the amendment must have been intended to accomplish, would create radical and destructive changes in our constitutional system and multiply confusion. Again, no ambiguity here. The Supreme Court is being perfectly clear in its language and in what it's saying, and you'll understand my emphasis on that point shortly. The Rushmore Court reiterates its repeated pre-16th Amendment holdings that taxation on income is, in its nature, an excise, entitled to be enforced as such. Okay, this is pretty clear, right? The unanimous Rushmore Court flatly holds that the income tax was, is, and remains an excise tax, and that the 16th Amendment in no way whatever authorizes a non-apportioned direct tax. Okay? Every possible authority agrees, going forward into time, about what the Bruchsberger Court says. This is Cornell Law Quarterly, 1915-16 edition. The 16th Amendment, this is analyzing and reporting on the Bruchsberger decision, which is what the Cornell Law Quarterly was all about. 16th Amendment does not permit a new class of a direct tax. The amendment, the Supreme Court said, judged by the purposes for which it was passed, does not treat income taxes as direct taxes, but simply remove the ground which led to their being considered as such in the Pollock case, namely the source of the income. Therefore, they are again to be classified in the class of indirect taxes to which they by nature belong. This is the Harvard Law Review, 1915-1916 edition, on the same subject. In Bruchsberger versus Union Pacific Railroad Company, Mr. Chief Justice White, upholding the income tax imposed by the Tariff Act of 1913, construed the amendment as a declaration that an income tax is indirect, rather than an exception to the rule that direct taxes must be apportioned. Really clear, yes? Okay, we're going to look at it again. This is the Supreme Court again, later in 1916, after the Bruchsberger decision, dealing with another case, somewhat related, another tax-related case, saying, by the Bruchsberger ruling, it was settled that the provisions of the 16th Amendment conferred no new power of taxation, but simply prohibited the previous complete and plenary power of income taxation possessed by Congress from the beginning from being taken out of the category of indirect taxation to which it inherently belonged and being placed in the category of direct taxation subject to apportionment by a consideration of the sources from which the income was derived. That is, by testing the tax not by what it was, a tax on income, but by a mistaken theory deduced from the origin or source of the income taxed. Here's the Supreme Court again. This is 20 years later, 1937. If a tax is a direct one, it shall be apportioned according to the census or enumeration. Again, if a tax is a direct one, it shall be apportioned according to the census or enumeration. Perfect clarity. There are no exceptions to the apportionment rule for a direct tax. Again, this is 20 years after Bruchsberger. This is the House Congressional Record of March 27, 1943. It's the testimony of former Treasury Department legislative draftsman F. Morse Hubbard. This is the fellow that wrote tax law. The income tax is an excise tax with respect to certain activities and privileges, which is measured by reference to the income which they produce. The income is not the subject of the tax. It is the basis for determining the amount of tax. We'll get to that as the significance of that a little later. The amendment, 16th Amendment, made it possible to bring investment income within the scope of the general income tax law, but did not change the character of the tax. It is still fundamentally an excise or duty. Again, 1943. 1979, this is a report by Howard M. Zaritsky, the legislative attorney of the American Law Division of the Library of Congress, talking about the Bruchsberger decision. The Supreme Court, in a decision written by Chief Justice White, first noticed that the 16th Amendment did not authorize any new type of tax, nor did it repeal or revoke the tax clauses of Article I of the Constitution quoted above. Direct taxes were, notwithstanding the advent of the 16th Amendment, still subject to the rule of apportionment. 1979 now, congressional legislative attorney, specifically declaring that the Bruchsberger decision held the tax to be an excise, not a direct non-apportioned tax, and that it ruled that there were no direct non-apportioned taxes of any kind still. 1988, South Carolina versus Baker, the U.S. Supreme Court again. The sole purpose of the 16th Amendment was to remove the apportionment requirement for whichever incomes were otherwise taxable. This is a little bit of a more obscure statement of the same principle. The court is saying that the 16th Amendment did not permit a tax on anything and everything that comes in, on undistinguished revenue. It only applies to things which had already qualified prior to the amendment as subject to that tax. Okay, summarize. The Supreme Court's words in the Bourgeois, this is what we've seen, the Supreme Court's words in the Bourgeois ruling itself, the 1916 Cornell Law Quarterly and Harvard Law Quarterly reporting on the Bourgeois decision, the Supreme Court referencing and reiterating the Bourgeois ruling in 1916, 1937, and 1988, the Treasury Department's tax legislative draftsman in 1943, and the Library of Congress's legislative attorney in 1979 discussing the Bourgeois ruling. All agree that Bourgeois rules the income tax to always have been and to still remain an indirect excise tax, that the 16th Amendment does not authorize any kind of non-apportioned direct tax, and that non-apportioned direct taxes remain constitutionally prohibited. Is that clear to everyone as we proceeded? Okay. The Bruchemer ruling is the thoroughly settled law of the land. Every institution of government knows that and knows what Bruchemer says. Now, let's take a look at the lies. Despite the absolute clarity of what the Bruchemer Court says and what remains the settled law to this day regarding the meaning and effect of the 16th Amendment and the nature of the income tax, in 1980, a federal appellate court makes this bizarre and manifestly false pronouncement. This is the Eighth Circuit in United States versus Francisco in 1980, and it says, the income tax is a direct tax. See Bruchemer versus Union Pacific Railroad Company. The purpose of the 16th Amendment was to take the income tax out of the class of excises, duties, and imposts and place it in the class of direct taxes.
That's just the opposite.
It is a lie. It's just simply a flat lie. There is no, this is not a mistake. This is not an error. This is not an oops moment. This is a false statement of what Bruchemer says, which everyone knew was a lie. I mean, everyone except, unfortunately, Francisco or his attorney, because no argument was made afterwards, to my knowledge, that this was a lie, and Francisco suffered harm because of this ruling. In 1984, another federal circuit court, the Fifth Circuit in Parker versus Commissioner, says, the Supreme Court promptly determined in Bruchemer versus Union Pacific Railroad Company that the 16th Amendment provided the needed constitutional basis for the imposition of a direct non-apportioned income tax. For decades, the IRS has published the same lie. This is a portion of an IRS post on their website, and this also, the same material appears in many of their printed publications. The law. The courts have both implicitly and explicitly recognized that the 16th Amendment authorizes a non-apportioned direct income tax on United States citizens, and that the federal tax laws as applied are valid. In United States versus Collins, the court cited Bruchemer versus Union Pacific Railroad and noted that the Supreme Court has recognized that the 16th Amendment authorizes a direct non-apportioned tax upon United States citizens throughout the nation. In fact, what's actually said by the Collins Court is actually worse even than the little portion that the IRS cites. This is what the Collins Court actually says. For 75 years, the Supreme Court has recognized that the 16th Amendment authorizes a direct non-apportioned tax. See Bruchemer versus Union Pacific Railroad. This is insanity. These lies by panels of actual U.S. appellate court judges in actual rulings by which actual Americans suffered actual and substantial harm are grossly, egregiously, and staggeringly criminal, and so glaringly false as to raise the specter of dementia. This is the sort of behavior that should land these judges in prison, if not facilities for the criminally insane. These lies are also fundamentally despotic in nature and purpose. This fact is ironically underscored by the 1984 date of the Parker ruling quoted above. Like the other judicial lies about Bruchemer and its law of the land ruling concerning the nature of the income tax and the ongoing constitutional prohibition of any kind of non-apportioned direct tax, the Parker Court's falsehood seeks to exploit a dynamic George Orwell insightfully explained in his book 1984. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. The object of all the judicial lies is to enable the perpetuation of an ignorance tax scheme by corruptly falsifying history. We're going to get to the nature of that scheme in a moment. All told, the behavior exposed above is nothing less than subversion. These judges and their present-day mimics, co-conspirators, and enablers were and are oath-breaking enemies of the Constitution, engaged in a deliberate and sustained assault on the rule of law in America. The reasons for the lies. At this point, you must be wondering just what is going on, and you should. And the reason for all of this is because excise taxes are privileged taxes. What does that mean? Well, as has been shown, the lies by some courts and by the tax agency are meant to hide the fact that the 16th Amendment didn't authorize a non-apportioned direct tax, and that in concert with all other branches of government, the Supreme Court definitively holds that the income tax is an excise tax. The reason they don't want you to know this is because excise taxes are privileged taxes and cannot fall on all that comes in, or in fact on anything that comes in if it doesn't proceed from the exercise of a privilege. To some, this will sound unbelievable. We're going to look at proof in just a moment. But first, I want you to think about this. If what I just said and what I'm just going to show you about excise taxes or something just as significant under whatever name isn't true, why lie about Bruchemer? Why would these courts that we just saw lying outright about what the Bruchemer court says, why would they do it? There's no reason for them to do it if what Bruchemer said actually authorizes what's going on out there today. If it actually authorized what these courts wanted to rule and what they did rule in those cases, which was that the tax is a tax on whatever, everything that comes in. If you make money, you have to pay the tax. That's what these courts ruled. If that's the case, then why lie about this? The fact is it is not the case, and that's the reason for the why, or for the lie. Why say the tax exists because of authorization by the 16th Amendment, rather than acknowledge that it was originated in 1862 and was merely resumed in 1913 as another aspect of the question. That is, if the rules or nature of an excise tax allow for the imposition of a tax the way you experience the income tax today, why try to hide or evade the fact that the Supreme Court says it's an excise? And why lie about its date of origin and about the Supreme Court flatly holding that non-apportioned direct taxes are forbidden? If the fact that the tax is an excise didn't somehow hinder the application of the tax in the way the revenue-hungry government wants to see it applied, there would be no lying. This is clear enough, right? This is just common sense. This is, you know, everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten-level stuff, frankly. Okay, so that was a little bit of preparation against the possibility of brain freeze, because we've all been conditioned to believe all kinds of lies about this subject, about the tax. We've been conditioned, in fact, to believe the tax to be effectively a direct non-apportioned tax, a tax that could be laid right on us for exercising our rights to engage in economic activity, and without any apportionment control whatsoever. So here are the details about what excise taxes actually are. Supreme Court, again, quoting and reiterating an earlier Supreme Court on the same subject, as was said in the Thomas case, this is Flint versus Stone Tracy, by the way, in 1911, as was said in the Thomas case, 192 U.S. 363, the requirement to pay excise taxes involves the exercise of privileges. Here's the House Congressional Record. This is F. Morris Hubbard again on this subject. We saw this earlier, but now it has context. The income tax is an excise tax with respect to certain activities and privileges, which is measured by reference to the income which they produce. The income is not the subject of the tax. It's the basis for determining the amount of the tax. Excise taxes are taxes on activities. They're not taxes on things. They're not taxes on money. They're not taxes on simply earning money. They're taxes on the exercise of privileged activities. We're going to see about more about that in a moment. This is Waters versus Chumley. This is the Court of Appeals of Tennessee on the subject of excise taxes and privileged taxes. Case law recognizes no distinction between a privilege tax and an excise tax. I'm going to skip the citations in this one. Whether the tax be characterized in the statute as a privilege tax or an excise tax is but a choice of synonymous words. For an excise tax is an indirect or privilege tax. The term excise tax and privilege tax are synonymous, and the two are often used interchangeably. The term excise tax is synonymous with privilege tax, and the two have been used interchangeably. What do we mean by privilege? That's a complicated subject in and of itself, but here's an example of the Supreme Court, here's Black's Dictionary giving a definition in general of the privilege concept. Privilege, a particular benefit or advantage enjoyed by a person, company, or class beyond the common advantages of other citizens. An exceptional or extraordinary power of exemption. A particular right, advantage, exemption, power, franchise, or immunity held by a person or class not generally possessed by others. As an example, here's the Supreme Court in United States versus County of Allegheny, 1944, talking about an example of a taxable privilege. The government is an abstraction and its possession of property largely constructive. Actual possession and custody of government property nearly always are in someone who is not himself the government, but acts in its behalf and for its purposes. He may be an officer, an agent, or a contractor. His personal advantages from the relationship by way of salary, profit, or beneficial personal use of the property may be taxed. The privilege excise principle is very simple. For the government to be able to charge an indirect, non-apportioned fee or tax for engaging in an activity, the activity must be one done by permission of the government, rather than anything done by right. This makes the things done for which the fee can be charged necessarily and inherently an exercise of privilege. Payment of an excise tax is payment for the privilege of X, in the most basic sense of that expression. The reciprocal, of course, is that such a tax can't apply to things for which you don't need government permission, like trading your labor for pay with anyone except the feds, or engaging in any other economic activity not involving federal stuff. So, simply making money is not a privilege, and the courts are very clear on this. This is the Supreme Court in Butchers Union Company versus Crescent City Company in 1883. The right to follow any of the common occupations of life is an inalienable right. The court also says, it has been well said that the property which every man has in his own labor, as it is the original foundation of all other property, so it is the most sacred and inviolable. The patrimony of the poor man lies in the strength and dexterity of his own hands, and to hinder his employing this strength and dexterity in what manner he thinks proper without injury to his neighbor is a plain violation of this most sacred property. They're quoting Adam Smith from Wealth of Nations, Book 1, Chapter 10. Smith will come into our story in a moment. This is again the Supreme Court in Coppedge versus Kansas, 1915. Included in the right of personal liberty, this is after the 16th Amendment, by the way, not necessarily significant, but I'll point it out anyway. Included in the right of personal liberty and the right of private property, partaking of the nature of each, is the right to make contracts for the acquisition of property. Chief among such contracts is that of personal employment by which labor and other services are exchanged for money or other forms of property. A matter of rights. This is the Supreme Court of Arkansas in 1925 in Sims v. Ahrens, and this is a very, very interestingly put quote, and I want you to pay close attention to it, read it carefully as it goes, and recognize that when this court uses the expression income, it is using the technical legal term income as it is meant in the context of the income tax. It does not mean what Webster says about it, which is one version or another of all that comes in, and how we use it in common speech. In the context of tax law, income only means the kind of stuff that comes in that governments can tax. Now, here's how this is put, and you'll recognize the significance of that in a moment. The legislature has no power to declare as a privilege and tax for revenue purposes occupations that are of common right. And in this, the Sims Court is simply reiterating what we've just seen the Supreme Court saying over and over again over the decades. If you do it by right, you can't be taxed for it. The right to engage in an employment, to carry on a business, or pursue an occupation or profession not in itself hurtful or conducted in a manner injurious to the public is a common right, which under our Constitution, as construed by all our former decisions, can neither be prohibited nor hampered by laying a tax for state revenue on the occupation, employment, business, or profession. Now, here's the significant little kind of mind bend portion. Thousands of individuals in this state carry on their occupations as above defined who derive no income whatever therefrom. You understand the distinction that's being drawn here between income as it is meant in tax law and income as you would think of it in general usage. This court is very, very, very plainly pointing that distinction out. Thousands of individuals in this state carry on their occupations, businesses, professions, employments, who derive no income whatever therefrom. They're getting paid, but they're not getting any income. That's the distinction between income as meant in the law and income as used in common language. But where an income is derived from any occupation, business, profession, or employment, that is to say, where the income as meant here, the income as meant in tax law, is derived from any occupation, business, profession, or employment, then the legislature may lay thereon a tax. Again, drawing that distinction between income as it is meant in tax law, the thing that's taxable, a taxable kind of stuff that comes in, versus the common usage income, where we just think of it as being everything that anybody makes. Okay? All right. And we can come back to this further in the Q&A if necessary, but I hope everyone has taken this in, because it really is a very telling expression. And if this didn't sink in, let it percolate in your mind for a little while. It's very important to recognize the distinction between income in the tax law and income in any other sense. It is by grasping that difference that you will suddenly, you'll have the light bulbs go off, and you will suddenly understand the income tax in ways that you never did before. Income in tax law always has quote marks around it. It has the quote marks that these statements by the Arkansas Supreme Court imply, even though they don't include them in the text. They're implying the quotes. This is the special kind of income that we're talking about here, and that's why thousands of people can make lots of money and not have any of it. But if your money does happen to be it, then we can tax it. Okay, and that's the distinction being drawn here. This is the Supreme Court of Tennessee in 1960, Jack Coal Company versus Alfred T. McFarland. Since the right to receive commonly defined income or earnings is a right belonging to every person, this right cannot be taxed as privilege. Can't say it any more clearly than that. The privilege element of the income tax is established independently of the legal character of the constraints native to excises as well. We're going to look in another direction in which we can understand the nature of the tax. And again, what we're talking about here is, we're talking about what the income tax actually is. We're talking about what the income tax is within its constitutional parameters and within the parameters of the ruling Supreme Court, the reigning Supreme Court decision on this subject, which is Bruchheimer. And you can know that actually, or settle any doubts about the subject of Bruchheimer being the law of the land on this subject by the very fact that the three appellate courts whose rulings we looked at earlier, that's who they cite to when they lie about the case. If Bruchheimer had ever been overturned or overruled by anyone else, they'd be citing to who that was. And that may have been one that actually said what they say Bruchheimer says, but there are none. And that's why they cite to Bruchheimer. Okay. Privilege element of the income tax is established independently by the legal character and constraints native to excises as well. A tax on or measured by unprivileged receipts is a capitation, which is inherently and constitutionally a direct tax. This is the Supreme Court in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust in 1895 discussing the meaning of capitation. This is, in fact, possibly the only case. It's the only case I've found, and may very well be the only case in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, in which the meaning of capitation is actually laid out. Very critical case, a very critical definition. Most people, in fact, most constitutional attorneys even, have no idea what capitation means. They've never seen a ruling, they've never seen this, and therefore they've never seen a ruling that actually explains it. They take it for granted that, you know, it has some accounting meaning or something like that, or who knows. But in any event, this is what it actually means, the Supreme Court has said. Albert Gladden, in a sketch of the finances of the United States, published in November of 1796, said, "The most generally received opinion, however, is that by direct taxes in the Constitution, those are meant which are raised on the capital or revenue of the people." He then quotes from Smith's Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and continues, "The remarkable coincidence of the clause of the Constitution with this passage in using the word capitation as a generic expression, including the different species of direct taxes, an acceptation of the word peculiar, it is believed, to Dr. Smith, leaves little doubt that the framers of the one, that is, the framers of the Constitution, had the other, Smith's definition of capitation, in view at the time, and that they, as well as he, by direct taxes, meant those paid directly from and falling immediately on the revenue." Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations was a 1776 publication. It was read in huge numbers by the founders, the founding generation. He is effectively the father of modern economics. The founders were avid students of this. He also wrote effectively on legal matters as well throughout the course of his work. And as the court says, and as Gallatin, who was the Secretary of State, a senator, congressman, ambassador to France, I believe, he was the longest running Secretary of the Treasury in U.S. history, I think, still. Very, very impressive resume, astonishing resume, in fact. Says at the time, contemporaneously, that Adam Smith was, in fact, the one who gave the framers the definition of capitation. Here is Adam Smith, the expert source relied on by the framers in their choice of terms in the constitutional taxation provisions, describing some of the tax applications and practices encompassed by capitations, which are also known as poll taxes, by the way, an expression which, in this context, has nothing to do with voting. "The taxes which, it is intended, should fall indifferently upon every different species of revenue," that is to say, just like what, you know, we imagine the income tax to be today, right? Falls just on, you make money and there's tax on it, right? Isn't that the sense that you're led to believe constitutes today's income tax? "The taxes which, it is intended, should fall indifferently upon every different species of revenue are capitation taxes. In the capitation which has been levied in France without any interruption since the beginning of the present century, people are rated according to what is supposed to be their fortune by an assessment which varies from year to year. In the first poll tax, some were assessed at 3 shillings in the pound of their supposed income." This is Adam Smith from An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. Maybe we can't get to the bottom portion of that, but book 4, and I don't recall the chapter, 1776. Here is the definition of capitation from the Official Law Dictionary of Congress when the income tax was enacted in 1862. "Capitation, a poll tax, an imposition which is yearly laid on each person according to his estate and ability." That's Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 6th edition, 1856. "Capitations and other direct taxes must be apportioned. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. And as you will recall from what we looked at when we were looking at the reiterations of the Bruchemer decision earlier on, for instance, in Stewart Machine Company versus Commissioner, we saw that nothing has changed in that rule. Direct taxes remain subject to the apportionment requirement. There is no such thing as a direct tax that can be administered without apportionment. If a tax is administered without apportionment, it cannot be direct. Those two things are married together under the constitutional structure. So we know by these legal facts that the unapportioned income tax cannot fall indifferently upon every different species of revenue, but instead can only concern distinguished revenue, which is to say revenue proceeding from the exercise of privilege, as in all excise taxes. So we come at it from another direction as well to see the definition of what the income tax is actually legally authorized to be. Here's the bottom line. The receipts subject to the federal excise, the income and the federal income tax are those produced through the exercise of certain federal privileges and no others. Just like the name says, it is a federal income tax. Not a federal income tax, like federal tax on all income, federal tax on everything that comes in. It's a tax on federal income, period. If it's not federally connected, it's not income. It's not subject to the tax.
That's it.
Yeah. Is that all? Brian's the only one who can give me a say what? Can I get a say what? Because yes, you've been fooled and lied to and screwed. You and your parents and or grandparents, for that matter, back to the early 1940s. That's when the scheme, All the Lying is Meant to Conceal, began in earnest. Only 75 years. Only 75 years. Prior to that time, people knew what the tax fell on. Starting in the 1940s and the tumult of World War II, and after years of the Great Depression and the onslaught of mass media engineering of consent through radio and so forth that Franklin Roosevelt mastered and took huge advantage of, the bulk of young American adults at that point had been through government schools for the first time in our history. A lot of things came together. Donald Duck was in every movie theater urging people to just fill out the tax forms and just don't ask questions. And some other things went on as well, all of which came together in sort of a perfect storm of BS. The matrix settled in place at that point, 75 years ago. That scheme involves tricking Americans into legally characterizing all their payments and receipts as privilege-related and therefore taxable by reporting them under one label or another as income on tax forms. And I see that slide got messed up a little bit. Sorry about that, folks. The lies about the nature of the tax shield the subterfuge from exposure by obscuring the relevance of the privileged-unprivileged distinction. That's what the courts are trying to fool you with. That's what they're lying about. They want you to not understand the privilege component of the tax. The effect of these lies and other crimes in facilitating the revenue and corresponding growth of the state is dramatic, as vividly shown in this graph charting the growth of the federal government. I want you to look at this. This is from 1792 to 2004. This is the size of the federal government over that span. You will see we have an actual hockey stick here. This is not Al Gore's baloney. This is a real hockey stick graph. We have a flat line, virtual flat line, from 1792 to 1943. A virtual flat line. A couple little bumps. There's a little bump here at the war between the states. A little bump for the First World War. And then, starting in 1943, we went from an average tax return completion rate of households across the country of below 9%. That was the average over all of the years of the income tax prior to that time. 80 years. Now, it wasn't applied in all those. I mean, the tax was not collected in all those years. There were a couple of periods where it was dormant. But over the entire span, the average percentage of households in America that were obliged to complete an income tax return was below 9%. By 1945, it was 93%. Anybody remember the constitutional amendment that took place in 1943 that changed everything? No, there was none. The law didn't change. Even the exemption rate didn't change. Nothing changed except that perfect storm of obfuscation that I talked about, thanks to World War II going on, Donald Duck making his videos everywhere, his cartoons everywhere, government schools, a drumbeat of, I'm sorry?
The victory tax?
Victory tax was a component. It was one of the ways of slipping the camel's nose under the tent flap. At that point in the 40s, the government suddenly decided, after having passed the current Tax Payment Act of 1943, which resumed withholding, which had been on hiatus since 1916, and had always been in the tax from the 1862 on, the withholding structure was in place. In 1916, they put it in abeyance for a period of time, and in 1943 they revived it under the current Tax Payment Act of 1943. And when they did that, they instituted a bunch of terminology, a bunch of statutorily defined terms, such as wages, employee, employment, and so forth. Once this act was in place, the government sent tax forms to businesses across the country saying, report all the wages paid to your employees. They didn't include the definitions. They just said, we want you to report all the wages paid to all your employees. And people took these things and, I got, 40 employees. I guess I pay them wages. And they wrote it all down and they sent it in and they signed under penalty of perjury saying that's what they had done. They had paid wages to these employees last year. Well, wages was a defined term in the law at that point. Under the Current Tax Payment Act of 1943, it referred to the pay given to people receiving income. Income in the quotes. Government workers. That's what it applied to. That's what wages is defined as. Employees are defined as those workers. And so all of these businesses across the country swore under penalty of perjury that their workforce was employees, made up of employees, who were paid wages. And by doing it on that form, they were saying they meant those terms as those terms are defined in the statutes. Not that they had a workforce and that they were, they were a company, they had people working for them. And they paid them, which is all they thought they were doing. But what they were actually saying was, legally, they were saying, we have people who make this privileged type of gains and who act in these privileged capacities. And the government took all this stuff and said, okay, now we're going to send bills out to people, basically. We're going to expect people, we're going to see to it that these copies of these documents that make these statements go to all the individuals involved, and we're going to let them look at them and figure out for themselves that, I guess I have to put this in my tax form, says I have to put down whatever the wages are that are reported over here, so I guess I'll transfer that number, and then I go through the calculations, and it says if I had this much of that, then I have to send a check for this much to Uncle Sam. And that's how it began. And it worked. People fell for it. They're not accustomed to reading the law. They thought their government was a benign, Uncle Sam. I mean, it was looking out for their interests. It wouldn't fool them. It wouldn't trick them. Well, many still do. At that time, people were very much viewed things that way. That was the time of FDR and the fireside chats and World War II, where people were saving bacon fat, to send to the troops, and they were not buying tires so that the rubber was free. Many good things, considering the war effort, but they had become acclimated to that level of subordination, of just doing what they were told or doing what they were asked without question, without anything. That period, that generation, and then, of course, a lot of people were receiving what qualified as wages, too, because, we had seen a million people go into the armed services at that point. And we had just come out of a period where the works projects were going on, and under the Depression, the New Deal structure. It was a time when all of these things just kind of came together and allowed this subterfuge to work. And it did work. And since then, since that period of 1945, when we hit the 93%, we've stayed in the 90s ever since. It never got figured out. It never, the subterfuge was never revealed at that point. Until 2003. And that's the happy ending in progress. And this is not a sales pitch, by the way. This is just informational. This is what happened. This overall deception was laid bare in 2003 in Cracking the Code. Immediately upon the publication of Cracking the Code, readers began recovering amounts that had been improperly withheld or paid in against potential tax liabilities that they now realized didn't actually arise. And these folks learned what the income tax really falls on, and that in the past they had unwittingly participated in misapplying the tax to their own unprivileged earnings in just the fashion that I had described to you a few moments ago, which unfortunately most Americans continue to do today. Being serious law-respecting American grown-ups, they promptly said no more of that nonsense, because the law says this isn't how it works. The law, you either follow the law or you don't. And if you want to give gifts to the government, go ahead and give them. Don't call them a tax when you haven't done something taxable. Give it to them as just write a check. Say, we love you, and we love everything you do, and do more of it, please, and here's my money to do it with. Do that. But don't pretend that it's a tax. That is law defying. It's not law respecting. The recovered amounts include all normal federal, state, and local income taxes, as well as Social Security and Medicare taxes, which are just income surtaxes. They're income taxes, just like any other, even though they have special names. They're income taxes. Just as wages, as defined in the law, is income. It's just a special name for a special category of income. Educated Americans not involved in withholding situations have simply stopped falsely assessing themselves a tax and cutting checks to the various governments for amounts not actually owed under the income excise. Their hard-earned money never leaves their own pockets. Altogether, as best can be calculated, these now tens of thousands of American men and women have secured complete refunds of everything taken from them on more than 200,000 occasions, totaling more than $2 billion. You can see well over 1,000 documented examples of these at the website listed below, if you're interested. Unfortunately, the people responsible for the lies that we looked at are still scrambling to stay in power and keep their gravy train rolling. But things are getting dicier for them. They're getting dicier for them because you're here listening to me right now, because you're reading these words, because you've just seen the lies. You know the implications. And I'm hoping that you will share that information with everybody you can. This is critically important stuff. This is the Leviathan. Now, you know, if you like Leviathan, that's fine. Some people do. Some people, you know, they don't feel comfortable about having a really big, you know, vigorous, high-energy government, you know, a Hamiltonian state. I personally don't like that. I think that it makes us all more impoverished and certainly makes us all less free, but to each their own. But if that's how you feel, give them your money, but just give it to them. Don't try and perpetuate or allow the perpetuation of a fraud by which it is believed and it is encouraged to be believed that everyone is subject to a tax that they really aren't in order to have your way and have a big government. Just give them your money. Let's see how that sorts out. A couple of notes of places where more information can be had. I encourage everyone to visit losthorizons.com, the 16th.htm, and get a detailed explanation of that perfect storm that took place in 1943, the details about the history of the tax and the history of the 16th Amendment, and a great deal more, actually, in what really is a fairly concise 25-page paper that I think everyone will find of great interest. And that's all I got.
Good morning and welcome to today's BKD National Financial Services Group webinar. Today's broadcast is part two of our CECL webinar series, focusing on CECL and business combinations. Our presenters today are Nancy Foringer and John Hemmer. Nancy has more than 25 years of experience providing business valuation services for financial reporting, estate and gift tax purposes, stock transactions, stock-based compensation, employee stock ownership plans, and succession planning. She leads BKD's financial institutions and financial reporting valuation practice. She is also an internal valuation specialist for BKD's Attest clients and consults on various valuation issues related to financial reporting. John has more than 10 years of experience in public accounting, specializing in providing accounting and consulting services to both privately owned and publicly traded financial services clients, ranging in size from $75 million to over $10 billion in total assets. He has provided various presentations to supervisory committees, audit committees, and board of directors on current banking issues, such as COSO 2013 Internal Control Framework, Fiducia Rule 363, Business Combinations, Capital Adequacy, Internal Audit Framework, and Control Structure. Again, thank you for joining us for today's webinar. At this time, I'll pass it over to Nancy.
Good morning. Today's webinar addresses a topic that really hasn't received much discussion yet. Most of the CECL presentations thus far have focused on the implementation and mechanics of the calculation itself, but CECL has some surprising and somewhat perplexing impacts to banks involved with business combinations. Today's focus will be on issues specifically related to loan receivables, But as a reminder, ASC 326 and its changes affect other financial instruments measured on an amortized cost basis. This webinar is going to be important to you if you have made acquisitions in the past and will still have acquired loans on your books under CECL. It also impacts you if you plan to make acquisitions subsequent to the implementation of CECL. As a brief reminder here, the effective date for SEC filers is 2020, 2021 for PBEs that are not SEC filers, and 2022 for everyone else. So today we're going to start by providing an overview of the current practice for loans acquired in a business combination, both the day one and day two purchase accounting as well as the allowance. Then we're going to talk about what's going to be changing under CECL and follow up with transition accounting. The current practice for acquired loans under ASC 805 really involves two components, your day one or the initial acquisition accounting and day two or ongoing accounting subsequent to the transaction date. Currently, the loans can be accounted for under ASC 31020 or in the case of PCI or purchase credit impaired loans under ASC 31030. The day two accounting involves accreting that initial valuation discount or premium over time as loans pay down or off, and under ASC 31020, both the yield and credit components are added together into a single discount or premium created, and under 31030, there's an accretable and a non-accretable component that needs to be measured. For many banks, the existing valuation discount related to 31020 loans is initially considered to be sufficient to cover any losses that might be required under the existing incurred loss model. So there's no additional allowance related to those acquired loans being accounted for under 31020 until they age or show signs of credit deterioration greater than what was initially estimated. And on 31030 loans, if there is further credit deterioration beyond what was initially estimated, then an additional allowance would be made. Now, as a reminder, the accounting that governs business combinations is contained in ASC 805, which in turn refers to ASC 820 for the definition of fair value. And that fair value definition is really an exit price notion that's based on market participant assumptions. It involves measuring both the interest rate and the credit component differences of the subject portfolio. And in practice, this is estimated almost entirely using a discounted cash flow methodology to calculate those expected cash flows that incorporate prepayment, default, and recovery assumptions. And CECL, while it may sound, some of the elements may sound similar, it's important to note that CECL is not fair value. While the concept of measuring that expected credit loss over the loan life is the same, this table highlights some of the key differences here. The expected credit loss assumptions and the measurement methodologies may be different under 31026 and ASC 805. Under CECL, this is based entirely on entity-specific assumptions. So you are currently gathering your entity's loss history, and you're able to determine which methodologies you want to use for different loan segments. Under ASC 805, it's based on market participant assumptions. While entity and market participant assumptions could be similar or even identical, you would need to go through some additional considerations under ASC 805 to document that that would be the case. Another difference is the almost exclusive use of, as we've mentioned, of the discounted cash flow method used to measure fair value under ASC 805. Under 326, there's considerable flexibility regarding that measurement method. And while a DCF can be used, it's anticipated that it's not likely to be the predominant method used by most banks. It's time now for our first polling question. Which of the following is not a difference between CECL and fair value? Consideration of a market interest rate, expected credit losses over the loan's contractual term, consideration of market participant assumptions, or not sure. You're going to have about 30 seconds to respond with your answer. Okay, most everybody got that right. Both CECL and fair value are looking at estimating the expected credit losses over the loan's contractual terms. It's just that the assumptions and the methodology used for that measurement may be different between the two. The consideration of market participant assumptions is used under fair value, but not under CECL. Which leads to an interesting observation. Let's assume that an acquisition is made after CECL is fully implemented for all institutions, so after 2022, and the effective date of that acquisition is in early January. There is the potential for three different measurements of the expected credit loss of that same portfolio around the same measurement date of 12/31. You could have the target institution. Of course, they're going to have their allowance that they would have recorded using their data and their methodologies. You're going to have that of a valuation specialist prepared for the fair value accounting under ASC 805. And then you're going to have the acquiring institution look at that portfolio and use their data and methodologies for the expected credit loss. And while hopefully there isn't much difference among these three potentially different estimates, the potential is there because there is so much subjectivity involved with both the methodology and the estimates that or the assumptions that can be used. As mentioned previously, acquired loans that are not considered to be PCI are accounted for under 310.20, and that is remaining after CECL, as John is going to cover. Under this method, the total discount, both the credit and the yield component, are combined into a single discount or premium that is accreted over the remaining life of the loan on a level yield basis. Most commonly, banks are uploading this information on an individual loan level basis to the core system, which then tracks it for day two purposes pretty efficiently. And as mentioned, the common practice has not been to create an additional allowance immediately, and you can so-called hide behind the discounts for these loans until much later in time. And as anyone who has acquired PCI loans knows, the process is a little bit more manual and involved for 310-30 loans. This is going away after CECL. But under 310-30, you're keeping track of the non-accretable and accretable balances, remeasuring that on a periodic basis subsequent to day one through resolution. And this is being tracked either on spreadsheets manually or with a third-party vendor. To summarize, the adjustments to the allowance for loan losses under the current reserve methodology for any acquired loans typically takes place sometimes subsequent to the acquisition. For those 310-20 loans, you're evaluating it periodically, but not really needing to book a provision until much later after acquisition because of the initial discounts that you are accreting. And then also on those 310-30 loans, you have the non-accretable portion, which may never change unless at some point in time the expected losses exceed what was initially estimated. All of this is going to change, though, under CECL, as John is now going to review.
Thanks, Nancy. Now that Nancy's given you an understanding of where we're at and with business combinations and how to account for them under the incurred loss model, I'm going to talk about where we're going with CECL. So the first thing I want to mention is there's new definitions with the CECL standard within that, and that's ASC 326. There's the definition of PCD, purchase credit deteriorated loans on an individual basis or a pool basis, and everything else is going to be non-PCD. And further on, we will talk about what would be classified as a PCD credit and then to also talk about what could not be considered non-PCD. Within the CECL standard, you still have the ASC 805, as Nancy mentioned, under business combination that refers back to ASC 820 of how to define a purchase price from a market participant standpoint. And that's the part where you still may need a use of specialists in determining that valuation. If you, and many of you have used some in the past that have done acquisitions, but if you have not done them, you may still need a specialist to help you involved on any acquisitions in the future under CECL. And I'm also going to talk about day two purchase accounting. As we all would expect, there's going to be day two impacts that we need to consider and evaluate going forward after we make that initial day one adjustment. And then also talk about the concept of what the allowance is going to look like under the expected credit loss model under ASC 326. Accounting for business combinations under CECL is going to need to be looked at differently than what we currently are doing. Deal structures may be looked at differently and what prices are being paid or what's being booked as credit discounts. So things to keep in mind as we continue on with this presentation of if any deals that I've done in the past, how could they change in the future under CECL as we talk about these changes? I want to reemphasize, very important to know that PCI goes away under 31030. Nancy mentioned that as well, but 31030 kind of gets alleviated into ASC 326 for the CECL standard. So, and PCI goes away and it rolls into what's now classified as PCD, those purchase financial assets with credit deterioration. And the official definition of that is acquired individual financial assets or groups of financial assets with similar risk characteristics that as of the date of acquisition have experienced a more than insignificant deterioration in credit.
All right. Hopefully you guys are starting to learn a lot. Dealing with the whole layout, and this is actually considered part five of the truth about the income tax. You got to understand that there are a lot of factors that's going to be making its way into the actual equation. Understanding how these changes in the tax code affect everyone who has received what you call income or deal with revenue is essential. It doesn't matter what industry you're involved with. It doesn't matter exactly how you acquired it. How you report and how you implement current expected credit loss provisions is greatly going to determine whether you sink or swim. Now, I got some very interesting information for those of you that probably, if you haven't, you know, heard this before. About 3 months ago, we had a recent change in one of the economies where they were greatly affected by these accounting changes, which turned one of the greatest economies, you know, in the last 10 years. You know, this particular country had one of the greatest economies in 10 years. And in the last, you know, 3 months ago, they went into a whole different status. But I don't want you to take my word for it. I simply want you to listen, because if you listen long enough, you will learn something. Remember, all I'm offering you is the truth, nothing more, nothing less. And always remember, if you listen long enough, you will learn something.
What's up, everybody? My name is Joe Brown, and this is Heresy Financial. A bit of shocking news was reported recently by Bloomberg about something that is happening recently in Venezuela. People in certain regions in Venezuela have reverted to a gold standard. That's right. They're not using paper currency anymore if they can help it. They're not using Bitcoin. They're not using cryptocurrencies. They're using gold. Physical gold to buy and sell goods, to do commerce. And while it might be surprising that something like this is going on, I'm going to share with you why it's happening and why it probably shouldn't be that much of a shock. Ready? Let's dive in. I'm sure most of you are at least somewhat familiar with what has been happening in Venezuela over the last couple of years. They went from being one of the richest nations on earth about a decade ago, had horrible monetary policy, dictator, socialism, all the garbage, and it ruined their economy, hyperinflation. They were the number one hyperinflation country in the world for a while. They were just passed up recently by Lebanon, but essentially the people in Venezuela have been hurting very much for a long time. I can't remember where I saw this video, but I was watching a video where they were interviewing a local in Venezuela about living through that hyperinflation, and they were in front of a hot dog stand, and the cost of one hot dog was equal to what somebody would earn in a month of working there. One hot dog costs as much as you can make in 1 month, which means that the only way that anybody was surviving was by having foreign currencies imported and sent in from family members who had left the country to go find work that paid in other currencies that were worth a lot more. Well, now people in certain parts of Venezuela have gone back to a gold standard. They are trading goods and services for physical gold. People are actually carrying around gold and using it for purchases. This isn't some electronic transfer of gold ownership that's stored in a safe or a vault somewhere. It's physical gold. And they're using it for small purchases as well, which might sound surprising considering you have a 1 ounce gold coin in US dollars that's worth $1,800. You're not exactly going to go be able to use that for a haircut down the street easily and make change for that. But what people are doing are using gold flakes. So there's a part of Venezuela where you can pretty easily mine for gold. You can pan for it. You can chip it off the rocks. There's little nuggets of gold in the rocks and the mountains that people will go and they'll operate their own little mining operations, chip off little pieces of gold, and they'll start using that to pay their employees. They'll buy stuff with it. There's an operator of a small hotel who is accepting gold anytime he can. He'll accept people to pay for the night in gold, and then he'll use that gold to pay his employees. And I think the funniest part about this is the picture that Bloomberg used for this article is of somebody who is carrying their gold flakes wrapped up in a bolivar. So anybody that tells you fiat currency has no intrinsic value, just take a look at this. You can always use it to carry around your gold. Now, for a lot of people reading this story, seeing this happen might be shocking, but it really shouldn't be surprising at all. And here's the reason why. What is happening in Venezuela right now has happened every single time there has been hyperinflation in world history. Every single time the story goes like this. You have a government or a central bank who engages in reckless monetary policy. Prices spike as a result of that expansion of the money supply. You then have a crisis of confidence, lack of faith in the currency. People start dumping the currency as fast as they can, triggering hyperinflation, and that hyperinflation then causes people eventually, without the government, to go back to using a gold standard, and sometimes in history it's been a silver standard. It's a bottom-up process of going back to the gold standard, and once that practice of using gold or silver in some cases makes its way throughout most of the society, then the government, then the central bank, then they change their practices, then there's a top-down response to re-back a new currency with gold or silver. But every time you've seen hyperinflation take place in history, there has been, even if it's a black market, a market has developed where people go back to using gold and silver for daily commerce, and it's not necessarily recorded in the official documents because you're not going to see this take place from the top down. The top down, the official documents, they're still going to be showing official exchange rates. They're still going to be showing, hey, this is what the currency is worth. But from a bottom-up level, people on the streets, people on the ground, usually start using more stable forms of money, and most of the time throughout history, that's going to be gold or silver. Now, to be fair, it's not everybody in Venezuela doing this, and if you are closer to one of the borders of one of the bordering nations in Venezuela, those people are most of the time going to be using the foreign currency from the bordering nation. So the people who are on the border next to Colombia are using the peso. People on the border next to Brazil are using the real. And to be honest, if your currency is going through hyperinflation, you would prefer pretty much any other currency in the world over your own. But for the people who aren't next to the border of another nation with a stronger currency, and they can go and do real work, get real gold, something that has a global exchange rate, something that is very stable globally for thousands of years, they can go and get that and use that to pay for things that are now being denominated in gold. To stay at the hotel, it's a half a gram per night. To get lunch for two, it's a quarter of a gram. And this also goes to show why gold organically emerged as the money of choice for most people for most of human history, because it's easy to make sure that gold is real. And for those of us who swipe a card or use Apple Pay for every single transaction, might be hard to think this way, but gold has physical properties that make it very easily identifiable. You don't have to be an expert in geology to be able to recognize gold, especially if you're dealing with it every single day. So while the practice of using gold as money, going back to a gold standard, has been growing inside Venezuela, the chances that this has any global impact, any broader impact outside of Venezuela, probably very unlikely. But it just goes to show the forces of history are very strong. And when you watch something happen over and over and over again throughout history, you can then look at it happening again in a place like Venezuela, make a bet that says more than likely they're going to do what everybody else did, which is revert to a gold standard. It's not guaranteed, but the chances are high, and Venezuela just fell in line with every single other occurrence of hyperinflation so far in world history. As always, really appreciate you guys. Thanks so much for watching. Have a great day. What's up, everybody? My name is Joe.
All right. Now, this next clip, you need to pay attention and take notes. Now, normally I don't do stuff like this, but I'm feeling like I need to bless everyone for at least sticking around and being, patient as they learn what's getting ready to take place under today's topic, the truth about the income taxes. So I'm going to bring to you a gentleman. His name is Chris. Chris is going to talk to you about the 1099A and 1099B. And let me give you a disclaimer. Everything you're going to hear in this particular broadcast, everything you've heard up until this point is for educational purposes only. We do not profess to give legal advice. Each and everything that you're listening to is for educational purposes only. If you hear anything within this broadcast that may spark you to seek things from a legal perspective and you may seek legal advice, we ask you to go seek those individuals and entities that provide legal advice, because here on WTDTA Radio, all we are delivering is educational information only. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more, nothing less. Chris is going to talk to you about the 1099 and 1099C. It's entitled, It's Your Money. Use it when you need it. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you're going to learn. Take notes.
Good morning, chosen few. Those of you who are still hanging around, thanks for coming back. Here's the deal. I've touched on some things in the past and briefly spoke about them. And today I want to talk about one of the things that I'd mentioned. One of you out there, I'm not going to mention any names, but actually quite a few, that one suggested that I maybe do a little video on this. And my intentions was to do this, but I wanted to shake off the unchosen. If you're watching this video, then you are one of the chosen. Or your police, and that's okay. You're chosen to be here too. You need to hear what's going on. You can't stop it, but you need to hear it anyway. So, and like I say, man, anybody, any of this information I'm putting out here, if you can prove it wrong, man. Send me a video proving it wrong, and I'll put it on this channel. But prove it. So the information I'm going to share today, I didn't want to share to the general viewer, only those that could stick around long enough, because using this in the wrong way, in a greedy type way, doesn't ever go over too well. You need to use it conservatively. You need to use it wisely, and that is the 1099A. Acquisition or abandonment of secured property. The other one is the 1099C, which is cancellation of debt. That's what I want to go over today, folks. This may be a long video. I don't know. It depends on how much I get into. But the man that turned me on to this, I'm not going to mention any names, but he showed me how to do this, okay? And his example was through automobiles. And what he was doing is he was taking these 1099As to the dealership, and he was buying one brand new car every month. He bought his wife a Cadillac, and then when he seen that he could do that, he started doing it every month. But what he was doing is he got greedy. He was using this to buy a vehicle. He would like say he'd take you to the dealership, pick you one out. You'd pick it out, and then what he would do is he'd buy it with the 1099A, and then what he would do is turn around and sell it to you for 60% of the cost. He was making pretty good money at this. And then after about 9 or 10 months of doing this, a couple of agents showed up on his doorstep, or at least that's what he told me they were. They told him, they asked him for his name. He's like, man, Chris, I thought I was busted. One officer told me his name. And then the other one took a couple steps back, and they were standing at the front door. He was in his bathrobe. It's like 8:30 in the morning. And the agent asked him his name. He told the agent his name. He said then the agent leaned in and said, look, Mr. James, nobody needs a brand new car every month. Limit your purchases to one new vehicle per year, per adult, per household. He said, then they walked away. So he said, that was at the close to the end of the year, October, November, something like that. He said, so I had to drive my trash truck around till January before I could do this. But see, greed caught up to him. The dealership that I dealt with, greed caught up with him. You cannot abuse this. You know, if you're going to get a new car, get a new car, you know, and then drive it, drive it at least till the warranty wears out. I wouldn't even get one every year. I'd just drive it till the warranty ran out and get a new one. Okay, so, but here we go. This is a 1099A, okay? I'm going to show you what one looks like, and then a little later on I'll come back and explain to you how to fill one out. This is a 1099A. This is one of the ones for $4 million that I sent to the Treasury. Okay, if you'll notice, take a really close look, you'll notice, or take a snapshot of this. I've covered up my Social Security number, or their Social Security number. But if you look at this document, it's simple. This comes, you have to get them from the IRS, okay? And you have to, they'll come in three copies. You have to have them from the IRS because they scan these things, okay? And then there's three copies. If you'll notice, there's a copy A, copy B, and copy C when you get these. These are carbon copied, okay? And up at the top, you'll see right up there at the top, right? That's the name and the address of the lender. Okay, and then if you look down there, you'll see their number. And then if you look over to the right of that, you'll see my covered up Social Security number. Then my name and address, okay? Then if you look over here, you'll see that there's a couple more boxes to fill out. One's the amount, and down at the bottom, you'll see where it says lien security. That's the description. If you're going to buy a car with that, you would put the year, make, model, and VIN number in that description, okay? And then you fill in the amounts. The date, number one box is the date. And number two and three are the fair market or balance of the principal outstanding or fair market value of the property. Okay, this is a photocopy of copy A. This is the one that was sent to the Treasury for the $4 million lien. Okay, they'll come three to a sheet. That's why this one's folded in half. I didn't want to cover up all the Social Security numbers, but there's three of what I showed you on this one sheet. Then what you do on the back of it, once you fill that out on the back of it, you're going to sign it with a beneficiary signature. Okay. here's a photocopy of one that I used in prison to show the inmates how to do this. See, it's just a photocopy, a black and white photocopy of what one looks like. You can print them off the internet like that, but you can't use them off the internet. They have to be the original from the Social Security. But see, I signed it with a beneficiary signature, and that's what you would do with this thing. It's a check. It's a check. It's going to be used as a check when you go to use this thing. I mean, think about it. Think about this for a minute. Okay? There's a two and a from, right? There's an amount. And on the back, there's a signature, like I showed you from this other piece here. You put your, so you flip it over and sign it just like a check. Okay? And I'll get into, you know, how you might deal with the dealership. But for now, I wanted to get into the instructions of this thing, because there's some things in the instructions that are going to blow you away. When you go to the Department of the Treasury Internal Revenue Service website, and you put in 1099A, 1099C, right? It's going to get instructions for forms. And it's, I don't know, I think it's like maybe 6 pages or something. Probably not even that. Probably just a couple. Yeah, front and back, like five pages, okay? And that's going to tell you how to fill this out. And in here it says, there's a description heading, property. Property means any real property. Real estate, such as personal residence, any intangible property, intangible personal property, except the following. And then it goes on to explain a couple of things that you can't. So then it goes on, it says, who must file? It says that multiple owners of a single loan, like the banks, government unit, a government unit or any of its subsidiary agencies that lend money secured by property must file a form 1099A. They have to. It's must, like shall, like the word shall. Subsequent holders, multiple lenders. You get a loan for your house. You get a loan for from the bank, and then the bank sells it to another mortgage company. Multiple lenders. But it'll go on to say on page 3, unless it's changed a little bit since 19 or from 2019. But it says, check this out. It says, who must file? And it talks about coordination with form 1099A. It says, if in the same calendar year you cancel a debt of $600 or more in connection with a foreclosure or abandonment of secured property, it is not necessary to file both the 1099A, acquisition or abandonment of secured property, and form 1099C for the same debtor. Think about this, man. You guys are going to want to go there and download this, these instructions and read them, man. This goes on to say, who must file? File Form 1099C if you are any of the following: a financial institution described in Section 581 or 591A, such as a domestic bank, trust company, building and loans association, or savings and loan association. 2, a credit union. 3. Any of the following its successors or subunits of one of the following. A. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC. You see it on the bank. You see it on the doors of every bank. And those that are federally insured anyway. National Credit Union Administration. Any of the federal executive agencies, including government corporations. Check it out. Any military department, U.S. Postal Service, Postal Rate Commission, a corporation that is a subsidiary or a financial institution of a credit union, but only if, because of your affiliation, you are subject to supervision and examination by a federal or state regulatory agency. Check these out. 5. Federal government agencies, including a department, an agency, a court, or court administrative office, or an instrumentality of the judicial or legislative branch of the government. Any organization whose significant trade or business is lending of money, such as finance companies or credit card companies, whether or not affiliated with the financial institution. The lending of money is significant, is a significant trade or business if money is lent on a regular or continuous basis. Okay, check that out, man. That is crazy. The federal government agencies, including a department, an agency, a court, or court administrative office. Right? So what are courts? It's saying right here that they're administrative offices. An instrumentality of the judicial or legislative branch of government. They're filing these things, folks. When you do the bonds, or when they do the bonds, or you sign the bond, you underwrite the bond, they're going to file a 1099-A on that, a check, brothers and sisters, a check on your trust, and they're going to hit you with it, man. It's a really interesting read, and I would suggest that anyone interested in getting into this read it over rather well, and because once you do, you're going to comprehend what it is that you can actually do with these things. Okay, someone asked me last night, well, when you, it goes on to the debt cancellation, read that. I mean, these things can cancel your debt just like that. Most of the time, banks will send them. The brother I was talking to last night, he said that he had a car, you know, when they were down on their luck a little bit and missed the payments. I don't know if they were the last few or whatever. But they actually discharged the debt and didn't get the car. He claimed that they had that he hadn't got the title. They haven't sent him the title back for it yet. You know, and I suggested maybe apply for a lost title or sell it without one. Let the new buyers apply for a lost title, but. This thing is crazy. You can purchase things. Well, you can't. And this is, I'm going to get into explaining to how you work this. Okay. You go into the dealership. You pick out what you want. Even say you want to trade in your car that you're upside down on. For those that aren't familiar with that, that's where you owe more on the car than what you can get out of it. And you're upside down on it. That money that if they take it in a trade, don't you even have to haggle with these guys. You know, look, man, what will you give me on the trade-in on this particular vehicle that I'm picking out brand new? You know, say it's a couple $1,000 less than what you owe on it. What you're upside down on will just be added to the 1099-A. So they're going to pay off your old loan and then let you have the new thing, okay? The new vehicle. So you go in there, right? And, you know, here's the thing about it. You can fill these out, and you can sign the back of them, and you can give them to whoever. But if they don't accept it, you're out of luck. That's why it's important to know what you're talking about when you go in and roll up on these dudes, okay? Because the particular dealership that I dealt with, they were, oh, no, no, man, this sounds like fraud. I broke it down for them, you know. And when you go in there and say, look, man, you know, I'm looking at trading in this, my old car for this new one right out here. You know, it's an $80,000 Escalade or whatever, you know. Just whatever, dually, you know, Chevy truck, whatever, man. You know, I'm looking at trading this old car in on this, you know, if you spend more on them, they're probably going to give you more for your trade-in. So work that kind of deal out, and then tell them, and then first thing they want to do, they're not going to think that you're going to take care of this right away. They're going to want to finance it for you. I went in, I said, look, dude, my credit sucks, okay? This is back in 2016. My credit sucks, man. I'm telling you right now. But let me have the application. So I filled out the application. When I handed it to him, he went off and he came back and he said, yeah, your credit's not too good, dude. We're probably not going to be able to finance you. I said, well, look, I don't want to be financed anyway. He said, well, why did you fill out an application? I said, I'm going to take care of this debt within, you know, a month or two, straight up. And his eyes got really big, and I said, I guess he was thinking I was going to come in with a bank draft or something like that. And I told him, I said, no, I'm going to take care of this. I said, look at here, man. I said, I gave you that application, and because I gave that to you, you accepted a trusteeship in a fiduciary. You created a fiduciary obligation for the trust, and I broke down the trust for him, and I thought it was going rather well, and he's like, really, you can do that? Yeah, man, you know, if you decide, Mr. Dealership guy, that Chris needs a brand new, you know, Chevy dually, then you can do that because you're in a fiduciary obligation. If you think I need one, you can do this. And I'll fill out this 1099A and sign the back of it. And then you, acting as the trustee, can file this with the 1040V. Within 45 days, the Treasury will pay you. Oh, man, that sounds like fraud to me, man. I don't go to federal prison, you know. This is how this works. You don't know that they're doing this. These jokers out here that are fleecing your trust are using these 1099As. You're giving them trusteeship, and they're turning around and they're filing these, and because you gave them trusteeship, they can sign your name on the back of them, acting as an authorized representative. And then it goes to the Treasury, okay? So, and they're filing them. The courts are filing them. Yeah, I just read a list to y'all who's doing this stuff. How come it's okay for them to do it, not you? It is okay. So I told dude, he said, look, man, he said, we're getting ready to close. And, you know, I like to work some kind of deal out with you, but, you know, I don't, you know, want to take the chance. I said, okay. I said, give me a notebook. And he gave me a notebook. And I wrote down, basically breaking it all down, took about a page, not quite a page, you know, of what the transaction would entail. I said, here's what I want you to do, bro. It's not going to hurt you no more than taking a little time out to call your accountant and ask your accountant, you know, can you do this? Right? Ain't gonna hurt. I said, so tomorrow when you come in, you know, you got a little time between your sales of your cars. Go ahead and call your accountant and just read it to her. Just read it straight from what I wrote. He said, okay, you know, it was nice meeting you. It's really interesting to hear what you had to say. You know, I thought I had this dude pretty much hooked and ready to roll, but he's shaky. So I said, look, man, here's my phone number. I put it on the bottom of this paper. If you find that you, after talking to your accountant, that you can do this, give me a call at this number. And if you want to trade this car I'm upside down on, is a Dodge Caliber. Too small, man. I had a couple teenagers I had to haul around. So, yeah. I said, give me a call. And we'll take care of this this new purchase. So he calls me. He didn't call me the next day, but he called me the morning after. And he said, hey, Mr. Hauser. I said, hey, what's going on? He said, do you still want to make that deal? I said, do you still want to take the trade in and accept a 1099-A in lieu of a final payment? He said, first I asked him, I said, what's your accountant say? He said, man, I don't know who he's talking to, but they're a freaking genius. Yeah, do that. So he calls me, man, and I'm, yeah, man. He said, yeah, bring it down and, you know, clean it out and bring it down and you know, we'll do this. Bring your 1099-A. Like I said, I keep one in my glove box. For insurance. Keep one of these in your glove box. Get them from the IRS and keep them in your glove box. Put your two or three in there. Okay? Because you'll use these. If you get in an accident, this is your insurance. You're self-insured. Why are you out here paying freaking Allstate? You know, I got a young 20-year-old daughter driving. You know, driving an Accord, a 2016 Accord, and you know, it's $1,100 a year just to have her on them. Yeah, roll with these, man. They are proof of insurance. Like I said, you can go into any courtroom and say, look, you know, I'm self-insured. Prove that I don't have millions of dollars in my trust. If you can't prove that I'm not a multimillionaire based on the amount of money that's in the trust, well, then I am self-insured. Hey, judge, please find out how much money I've got in my trust. You know, if I don't have millions of dollars in my trust, prove that. If he goes to try and prove it, they're going to tell him, it ain't none of your business. Leave that dude alone, because they know me. You know, this is what we did. This is where the money's coming from. This is how we're getting even. You mess with me, I'm getting in your pocket. I'm taking your money, like my ex-wife. Oh, you ain't getting nothing from her. She's broke. She's filing bankruptcy. Well, I got it. So, and then you bank it. Once somebody asked me, they said, well, how do you know you're a secured party? There's $4 million right there, says I am. See there? I got 15 of these, bro. I got another 12. They say $12 million. So they're in the bank. Prove to me, Your Honor, that I don't have $4 million in my trust. And I'll go out and I'll call Allstate. But if you can't, you sure can't try me for a violation of the implied consent law. So that's pretty much that. I've got a list of emails from a lot of y'all that I've sent a bunch of conditional acceptances out already, and I'm trying to keep track of everybody. And I even had to buy me a new laptop just to do all this with. But you know, it's what we do. Get ready, y'all. Get ready. Some of y'all might not be able to work this. Some of y'all might not be able to. But you got to roll off in there like, hey, man, I got $4 million in my trust. Yeah, I can buy anything you got on this lot, bro. But you can't be greedy. You can't be greedy with this, man. You want to get a new car? Go get a new car. You want to go get an RV? Go get one. You want to get the trust or the beneficiary needs a new bass boat. If I got a new bass boat, then I have to have a nice truck to pull it. You know, if you can get the lenders at the bank to accept a 1099A, you can buy a house, man. Hey, trustee, the beneficiary needs that new mansion down on 12th Street, okay? It's for sale, and I need a new mansion. I got a big family. You know, I need a big house for my kick and ride his tricycle in wintertime, right? If you can convince them that you need this and it's in your best interest, well, then it's in their best interest to do you right, because if they're not, they're committing fraud. You know, if you want to make them lean a little bit more your way, say, hey, you know, you're the trustee in this trust, man, and you have a fiduciary obligation to the trust. You know, you have to do what benefits the beneficiary. If you're not, you're committing trust fraud. It's called malfeasance of office. It's a felony. So, you know, hey, man, you might want to try this. You know, and the cool thing about it is it's the dealership that's filing. If they're the ones filing it, they're just filing it on your behalf, man, trying to get you into where you need to go. But thanks once again for hanging out. This one is especially for you people that have stuck around long enough. You are the ones that deserve to know about this stuff. You know, the other, you know, there's over 4,900 views on the original video right now. We busted 9,000 viewers here yesterday. So, but there's a select few. There's about 150, 200 of y'all that stuck around. So, and I appreciate you all. So there's a little gift from old Chris. Have an early Merry Christmas.
All right. And with that, good stopping point for us to discuss the possibilities of understanding being in the right position. I'm going to suggest that after this broadcast, you go to 365 Live to get more exclusive information, because we broadcast this type of information 24/7, 7 days a week on 365 Live. I appreciate everybody's time and energy and actually listening to the information. If anything that you've heard in this particular broadcast is something that you are definitely interested in, it will be to your advantage to definitely take advantage. See, a lot of individuals really, really, really have to come to grips with how these things work and how important they are to move forward. Like I have in the next series, The Truth About the Income Taxes Part 6, where I'm going to literally break down the actual truth about the income taxes from a K-1 perspective, how you can use the K-1s in the same capacity as what you just listened to on the 1099s, the OIDs, and so forth from the right perspective, by having a legitimate business and being able to literally recoup and recapture the capital that's out there, all being done through tax returns. The hardest thing for most people to wrap their brain around is because they've been using tax returns, in my opinion, ass backwards anyway. Because when you get a tax refund, that means you're screwed up on the math. You know, it's a good thing. You know, you think it's a good thing. And, yeah, it's good to get your fiat back, but when you're not doing all the accounting, you're just basically heaving it up, you know, on the other end. And then if you're not benefiting from it, that's the thing. See, if you understand that the DTC, whether you learn this or not, they're monetizing their security interest in that Social Security trust. And all I'm saying to you is that if you are really serious about utilizing this stuff, then you have to do the proper accounting. You know, it's not a fly-by-night make-up something. No, you're going to have to do the math. And you got to have legitimate businesses and business relationships to make all this stuff work. You know how many clients I'm dealing with now that actually got the PPP but didn't have payroll? They got the PPP, then they went and got payroll. And they don't think that the IRS and everybody else is looking at that. They don't even do currency transaction reports. They did no CTRs, but for some reason, they have this sense of entitlement. And there's nothing wrong with that when you've been miseducated. Because, see, we're just going to say that you're ignorant. Now, ignorance is no excuse when you have the ability to do things right and make yourself applicable. I'm going to just see if we got any questions before we change gears here. And for those of you that are listening, if you want to call in, you got a few minutes. You got about 9 minutes before they shut it off, so you won't be able to call in. So if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything you've heard up until this point, call in now at 515-602-9723. Again, if you got any questions, comments, or concerns, and you want to ask direct questions, you can actually call in at 515-602-9723. Let me go to call line, see if we got any questions. Caller, last four digits of your number is 9280. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you've heard up until this point. 9280.
Islam. I like the content, man. I'm just listening, you know. I'm kind of working on that process, too.
Right. So you say you're kind of brainstorming on that 1099A and C process?
Yeah, in the 88, what phone was that, 8821?
Yep, got an 8821.
Yeah, the OID.
You know, right. You know, those processes can actually, it makes a lot of sense if you go to our website, Diversity Trust, diversityholdings.net. Again, it's www.diversityholdings.net. And if you go to the actual page that is entitled Today's Tax Topic, we have the entire breakdown of the perfection of the security interest. If you look at that process and examine what Chris was just talking about, you'll kind of get an aha moment. What we're going to bring to the light is that these forms are designed to recoup and actually collect the taxes that are owed. These forms are used to collect taxes that are owed. You're either going to pay a tax or you're going to receive a tax payment. The choice is yours.
Yeah.
But definitely, brother, if you go to that website, check it out, it'll really make more sense to you. Like I said, I'm going to be doing the truth about the income.
Yep, I'm right here. I'm right here on it right now.
Okay. Definitely check it out and look at it. You'll see how all those pieces come together. But definitely, that's what's up. Shoot, if you don't have any other questions, then I'm going to go down the line and see what's up and see what's happening, bro.
You know what page is on? Just scroll.
Yes, basically, if you toggle on the tab that says Today's Tax Topics, just you'll see the tab that says Today's Tax Topic, and then when you toggle on it, it'll be the first article. It'll say Perfection of Security Interest. You see it?
Yep.
All right. That's it right there. And like I said, if you study that, then that'll help you really kind of really see how like these other pieces fall together.
Yeah, definitely I'm about to bookmark
it
on my tab now.
Okay. That'll work. Well, shoot, let me see who's up and see what's happening there. Let me see what's up and see what's happening. All right. Let's see who else we got out here. Caller, last four digits of your number is 6918. 6918. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything you've heard up until this point.
Not at the moment. Thank you.
Not at the moment. All right. For those of you guys that are actually going to the website, diversityholdings.net, under today's tax topic, I'll kind of give this to you in this regard so it'll help make sense. So this next clip is going to be about how to perfect the security interest in an actual tax return. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more, nothing less.
Perfection of security interests in United States federal income tax refunds. From time to time, businesses anticipate receiving a large federal income tax refund. When such a situation arises, there may be a desire to borrow against the proposed refund in order to access the anticipated funds more quickly than they would otherwise be available. Secured lenders may also wish to perfect a security interest in future federal income tax refunds to further collateralize existing loans secured by all assets of a borrower. Both sides to a loan transaction may therefore be interested in the method to create and perfect a security interest in a federal income tax refund. Execution of security agreement describing the collateral. Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code governs security interests in most types of personal property. Because Article 9 does not expressly exclude federal income tax refunds from its scope, the grant of a security interest in a federal income tax refund is subject to the provisions of Article 9, Del. Code An. Tit. 6, Section 9-109A. Because no section of Article 9 expressly discusses federal income tax refunds, such refunds are deemed to be general intangibles. See Del. Code An. Tit. 6, Section 9-102A, 42, to create a security interest in a general intangible such as a federal income tax refund, a borrower must grant a lender a security interest through a security agreement or similar instrument. Under Del. Code An. Tit. 6, Section 9-203, a security interest is enforceable with respect to specific collateral against the borrower and third parties when, a, value has been given, i.e., a loan has been made, B. The borrower has rights in the collateral or the power to transfer the collateral, and copyright the borrower has executed a security agreement or similar instrument that describes the collateral, the security agreement, and the UCC-1 financing statement to be filed in connection with it, must describe the collateral in reasonable detail. Del. Code An. Tit. 6. Section 9-108A. Though a description such as all general intangibles is likely sufficient, a reference to the specific federal income tax refund in question, or at least a reference to all federal income tax refunds might be preferable for both the borrower and the lender. Execution of IRS and DOT forms. The execution and delivery of a security agreement coupled with the filing of a financing statement creates and perfects a lender's security interest in many types of personal property. In the case of a federal income tax refund, however, additional steps are necessary to allow the lender to obtain payment of the federal income tax refund directly from the IRS. In addition to the security agreement discussed above and the UCC-1 financing statement described below, a lender should also prepare and have the borrower execute the following IRS forms: A. Form 2848 Power of Attorney, Form 2848, and B. Form 8302 Electronic Deposit of Tax Refund of $1 million or more. Form 8302. Form 2848 allows an individual, other than the borrower, to obtain the federal income tax refund on behalf of the borrower. Part 1, Section 6 of Form 2848 requires the name of an authorized representative who will receive the federal income tax refund instead of the borrower. Form 2848 does not, by itself, authorize the authorized representative to endorse or cash the federal income tax refund. That requires an additional DOT form described below. For purposes of preparing Form 2848, the person named as the authorized representative must either be, A, an attorney, B, a certified public accountant, or copyright an enrolled agent as defined in Treasury Department Circular No. 230. In order for the IRS to process Form 2848 quickly, the person listed as the authorized representative should be an individual that has already received what is known as a centralized authorization file or CAF number from the IRS. If there is no such person, the IRS will assign a CAF number to the individual listed as the authorized representative. Form 2848 should be faxed to the appropriate CAF service center. In cases where the lender expects that the federal income tax refund will equal $1 million or more, the lender should require the borrower to execute a Form 8302 authorizing the IRS to wire the proceeds of the federal income tax refund to an account maintained by the lender for the benefit of the borrower, i.e., an account for the borrower that is located at the lender's financial institution. Form 8302 should be filed with the borrower's tax return, if possible. Otherwise, Form 8302 should be mailed to the same IRS address where the borrower files its annual tax return. In addition to the IRS forms referenced above, the borrower must also execute the following DOT forms: A, Form 235 resolution by corporation conferring authority upon an officer to execute a power of attorney for the collection of checks drawn on the United States Treasury, Form 235, and B, Form 234 general power of attorney for the collection of checks drawn on the United States Treasury, Form 234. The DOT forms authorize the lender to endorse the checks, or in the case of a wire transfer, to ultimately deposit the funds in an account for the benefit of the lender. Filing a UCC-1 financing statement. To perfect a validly created security interest in a federal income tax return, a lender must file a UCC-1 financing statement using the description of the collateral contained in the security agreement in the appropriate filing office under the UCC. DEL. Code AN. TIT. 6, Section 9-310A. In most cases where a lender is filing against an entity borrower, that financing statement should be filed in the office of the Secretary of State of the borrower's state of incorporation. DEL. Code AN. TIT. 6, Section 9-307E. Lenders should be aware that following the IRS and DOT procedures outlined in Section 2, above, will not absolutely guarantee that the lender will receive the borrower's federal income tax refund directly from the IRS. First, lenders should be aware that the IRS has not always honored Form 8302 and has in some instances mailed checks despite receiving a Form 8302. Second, a lender must keep in mind that a taxpayer has the right to revoke any of the above referenced IRS and DOT forms. While not a perfect solution to the problem, the loan documents related to the loan secured by the federal income tax refund should prohibit the borrower from revoking any of the IRS or DOT forms and should make any such revocation an event of default. The loan documents should also grant the lender a power of attorney to prepare and submit such forms if and to the extent needed as a result of such revocation, though it is not entirely clear that the IRS or DOT would accept a form executed on behalf of a taxpayer by a power of attorney. Third, a lender should keep in mind that the IRS has the right to use all or part of a taxpayer's federal income tax refund to offset a prior outstanding balance. Therefore, before making a loan secured by a federal income tax refund, a lender should obtain some familiarity with its borrower's prior tax filings and situation to confirm that no outstanding amounts are owed to the IRS at the time of the loan and that its borrower is not under an active audit at the time of making the loan. Mr. Strain and Mr. Flock are attorneys in our Memphis office.
All right. Mr. Strain and Mr. Frock are actually attorneys in the Memphis office. This particular office that actually wrote that particular article, because this is not something that Bezos Bay did on his own. This is actually me giving credit to the actual authors of that document. I posted that article on our website because it was the attorneys who brought forth this information on how to utilize the 8302 process to reconcile books when it comes to accounting. So there are individuals in the what you so-called public that know about these processes, but they only cohabitate with actual individuals that don't determine wealth by how much cash you have in your bank account, but how many resources you control. See, wealth is never determined by how much cash you have in the bank. It's determined by the resources that you control. This is why the elite are always articulating their assets under management by the resources that are attached to it. See, true wealth is determined by resources. Even in the biblical days, you know, when they were talking about wealth, it was about how much cattle or livestock you had, how much land you had. Resources. Wealth is always being determined by general and tangible assets. I hope you guys learned something. I hope this information leads you down the path to learn even more. Remember, all we're offering is the truth. Nothing more, nothing less. Matter of fact, as we close, this next song is done by an artist by the name of Lazarus. It's called Holder in Due Course. If you just learn the song, you'll learn a process. The entire song is a process. The song is entitled Holder in Due Course by an artist by the name of Lazarus. If you're enjoying the content of what you're listening to, then feel free to visit us on 365 Live, which is our base programming for more of the same content. I will be bringing forth the program and the continuation of this, which is entitled The Truth About the Income Taxes, which will be going into part 6. Peace and love, family. Peace and love.
Yeah, check it, man. Give you some of this, man. It's Holder in Due Course. Give you a little bit of the meaning real quick. Check it. Yeah. Holder in Due Course. In commercial law, a holder of an instrument who took it for value in good faith and without notice of any claim or defense against it. And who can enforce an instrument free from all claims and personal defenses? UCC 3-305.
This is what you do if you live in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course. This is what you do if you living in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course.
Once upon a time, I was issued a fine. Thinking in my mind, I wasn't focused on time. The cop gave me a ticket and told me to go to court. I was in my thoughts and saying it was a fraud. Authenticated my life birth certificate and claim that I'm the only one that can write a check off the name. Common law copyrighted my DBA. And it's backed by a bond called the GSA. All this property I got, they try to scheme on it. But tell the sheriff that I put a lien on it. They're hating on this land with the trees on it. I erected the trust and I put the deed on it. I wanna live in peace, but I can use force. It's cutthroat living when you in New York. The agent on the stand when we in the court, but he's not really the holder in due course.
This is what you do if you living in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course. This is what you do if you living in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course.
Got a mortgage loan, I discharge it without following the chapter 11. I'm trying to make connections and pass the message to my people, cause the mortgage over 5 years, man, is illegal. It's a crown in the fee simple estate. Rule 17, I'm coming in as the G. Open the books up when they dusty. Got a 3% interest for my trustees. Held a meeting with the chancellor. Got a 9-8 for my son, the grantor. Pushing all this paperwork, my hands sore. I don't make a contract with a landlord. Business on the private side, I'm foreign. I don't go to court and entertain the argument. I'm above the hypocrites and jargon. Now the prosecutor trying to make a bargain. Hoping I don't call upon the cavalry, cause we can go to the ocean and deal with amnesty. While I'm making prayer with my shoes off, endorsing all these instruments, the holder in due course.
This is what you do if you living in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course. This is what you do if you living in New York. DBA 130, holder in due course. In the temple, make a prayer with my shoes off. Rule 17, I'm a holder in due course.